Hello and welcome to the Echo Chamber Podcast. My name is Tony Groves, and today I am on my own because my co-host is currently on his way to the House of the Oireachtas to present his evidence to the Public Accounts Committee on bogus self-employment. And I sincerely wish him well, and I think it's great that he's getting this opportunity. He's decades campaigning on this as an activist. I think it's important that this gets debated. I think it's important that workers get treated as workers, and these, you know, the growth in the gig economy has to be looked at. Credit to Martin. Don't like to credit him too often, too publicly. But you know, fair play to him. And if you get a chance, it will be on Oireachtas TV, so you can probably have to watch it back. But he will be back on air shortly to talk about how he got on anyway. So we will bring you a reaction podcast if he passes out of there without any controversy, or maybe with just mild controversy. As always, podcasts on the Tortoise Shack are supported by you, the listeners, and it's patreon.com/tortoiseshack. Please do chip in, keep us going. Enough of that. And I am delighted to be joined by the Lord Mayor of Dublin, Hazel Chew. Hazel, how are you being?
How's it going, Tony? So I miss Martin too today. I hope you don't get too sad. So.
Yeah, no, I think we'll be okay for the purpose of this conversation. If my phone rings in the meantime, I just hope it's not a demand from someone to come and take him away. But nonetheless,
I'll come join you. In fairness, you stay put. I'll go over, pop over the side wall there, and go and rescue him for you. So
if you could,
I'm good.
Oh. It's been a up and down few days. It's fair to say. But I want to start right at the part that annoys me the most. The idea that a woman from an ethnic minority group getting on the ballot triggered such emotion of no confidence, first of all, and mild opprobrium from certain cohorts. What does that say about us in 2021 as a nation and as our politics? What does it say that is a weird way to react to something that just seems to be a democratic right and democratic norm.
Now, to be fair, so there's what is perception and what is the actual facts. The facts is there is a motion of no confidence because people didn't believe that my role as a chair was tenable. They believed that my role as the chair was untenable due to the fact that I had put in for nomination. And some people believed that there was a pact in place and that I was breaking this pact. And some people also believed that because our executive had decided not to host a selection convention, that I was self-selecting. Now, this all seemed kind of, so these, when I say facts, these are what I mean is these are the assertions. And the motion of no confidence is on my position as chair, not in terms of me putting my nomination in. My nomination, I like to think that my motives of it, of wanting to put more diversity and gender onto the ballot, will be taken as genuine and will be taken on face value. That hasn't been discussed yet, but what has ensued in terms of the discussion is slightly not quite disturbing. I'm not quite sure what the word is, but it does make you question, because whether you mean to or not, having this discussion when someone's name is on, for whatever reasons you're planning to discuss it, does make other people think this is a discussion based on race and gender. So even though it's not, and it becomes this mountain out of a molehill, and this is the thing I find most baffling, because last week we had the most ambitious climate bill that anyone in the state has ever put forward, but we spent the week talking about me. And as much as I love people talking about me, so I don't love it that much, but like it was just a bit odd. It was just weird, to be honest with you.
I'd go a step further, that at levels people will see that, and it sends a, first of all, we can talk about optics. The optics are bad. It sends a bad signal, particularly when our parliament doesn't resemble the electorate enough.
Yes.
That's a fact. Me and you have spoken previously off air, or we've had conversations about, and I've said it on air, that I think Fianna Fáil have missed an opportunity to put Aroimu forward when they had it. You know, this wasn't something, and I voiced those concerns to people within Fianna Fáil as well. I don't know if Aroimu would thank me for my canvassing on her behalf, but nonetheless, I think our politics should look and resemble the people it's supposed to represent. So the optics of this, Hazel, from the perspective of people who probably weren't even aware that there was a Shannon by-election happening, weren't good.
Yep, and this is the thing. Close this bin over here. But this is the thing. I think this is why I separated it out in what happened and what are the optics then, or what were the reasons of something happening, and then what are the optics element. And the fact that we couldn't control those optics and it became this massive issue is just, I tried not to comment on the last week, and I know I did a few podcasts and interviews, but I landed on the fact that, listen, these are my reasons for running. Whether you believe it or not, these are it. And also, we have this climate bill. Let's talk about that instead. So, but what it kept on getting dragged into was, why are you doing this? And I'm there going, I've already given you my reason of why I'm doing this. Whether you believe it or not is up to you. Like, if Fianna Fáil had provided for a candidate that was of a minority background and woman, it would have been amazing. So, and this is the thing that I find most uncomfortable, is that we are at this point in society where there's so much divisive rhetoric, and the divisive rhetoric might be coming from a minority, but that is growing bigger and bigger. Like, I'm not imagining it when I see people outside my door. So I'm not imagining it or making it up when there are petitions to get me fired. And people might go, oh, that's her complaining again, saying, woe is me. But I may be myself, but the whole point of why people are against me in this office is a larger issue, because it is very clear then they are against people of a different ethnicity or a different color being in this office. And unless we can make that normal, that people of different backgrounds can be in this office, can be any political office, then it will always be the same. And that kind of that divisive rhetoric will always win. And that's the thing that I'm trying to change. Like, I can make it easier for myself and just curl up in a ball and not run for anything, that especially one that I don't stand a hope of winning. So it's not fun when you say, hey, I'm going to run for this, when you know you're going to lose in 3 weeks' time.
Yeah, just on the numbers side of this, you can't win.
You can't. No, I know that. And I guess this is why a lot of people go, oh, Jesus Christ, you're burning down the party for something you can't win. I'm not burning down the party. I never intended to burn down the party. I never intended for it to get to a stage where people will be putting motions of no confidence against me. I was very clear when I talked to the press that I had full confidence in my leader and my parliamentary party. So if people had an issue with me, I expected people to talk to me about it instead of making it to this big...
Yeah, it's become a Ferrari. It's become a Ferrari. But, yeah. But can I put it back to you then, that that's also... Sadly, that's a part of the last 12 months for the Green Party. Unfortunately, there has been a pattern where some of your former colleagues have left, and you know, under a cloud, and there has been issues there. And your own leader, who you didn't vote for at the time when the leadership contest came up, he has spoken about a need to, you know, address the culture of, there was accusations of bullying and accusations of harassment of other individuals. So you know. If people are seeing that through the prism of the last 12 months, it kind of does look like something that was coming to a head anyway.
Yeah, and I'm not naive. I don't sit there going, hey, this isn't my fault entirely, or this isn't how it would look. The thing is, a lot of people will see it as unresolved issues from leadership contests or from issues of bullying put out there. And I can see where people are coming from that. And if I could, I would gladly have put my nominations in last week, but I couldn't get the signatures for it because I got the six from my colleagues and I had to go get others. So if I could time it better, I would have. And I think that's one of the things I do regret most out of this, that I, timing wise, if I had made sure I got all the signatures, it would have been great. But saying that, the people, everyone thinking that it is because of leadership, because of something else, it's not correct. There are issues, absolutely. Anyone that comes on and say, no, we have no divisions, I don't think they will be entirely correct. There are certain divisions, and it's always been the case that every party has divisions, but I don't think our ones are what people think they are. So our ones are based on the fact that we are a party that went from a very small party to now 3,500 members. We are a party that were previously sitting on the opposition, now in government. It's a very difficult position sometimes to resolve with oneself. And it's not that you don't want the government to work or you don't want the coalition to work. It's none of those things. But you want to keep your own identity while making sure the government and coalition works. You want to still be who you set out to be and not be subsumed into this whole machine.
Yeah, You've outlined that very well. I accept that, but I also think that within that, and quite, that makes it sound like there's only one sort of element within the Green Party. There's not. That's clearly not the case. There are certainly more. How do I put it? More radical elements. Some of them have moved on, but there remains an element that leans further to the left and more on the social justice, climate justice wing than there is, and some of that seems to have not been reconciled over the last 12 months either.
No. And well, we're always a broad church. If I tell you, no, we're only one side here, Tony, I'll be lying. And like, if anything, I think being honest, very honest, has gotten me into a lot of trouble these days, and I will continue doing so. But we are a broad church. We've always been a broad church. We've got elected because we were a broad church. Like, we got elected, a lot of our votes came from left votes, but it also came from middle, and it came from some from right as well. So this is the issue we've always had, that we've been one of those parties that have been lucky to get votes from everywhere. But that also means that when you are within a government and working towards aims, then part of the issue is if you don't go back to listen to your grassroots members that got you there, if you don't listen to the voters that got you there, those issues will bubble up. So like, if someone told me, oh, Greens are just going to move one direction, they're going to move to center or beyond that, then yeah, if that's the decision that's made. But for my part, I joined this party because I always believed it was a center left, more left if possible, party. I joined it because of the climate issues. I joined it because of the social justice issues. I don't think both are mutually exclusive. I think you can have both. The question is whether people do want to have both.
Yeah, which actually brings us very quickly onto the climate action bill, because again, you know, teething problems. It came first. And we were. I'm assuming you weren't happy with the first iteration of. As I was, pretty unhappy and vocal about it a few months ago. Between now and then, you know, it went away. It came back. It's gone back for other things and tried to make some changes. Yeah. Can you tell me, first of all, are you satisfied with the changes and some of the key things that you think are the big wins in it?
I am. Like, I like a lot of people, and we did get a lot of people come out and say, this isn't good enough. So, like, let's call a spade. You did, a lot of climate NGOs did. And then it went through various iterations. This is why it goes through scrutiny from opposition, from ourselves and from our own party. And what it came out on the other end was something that is actually very ambitious. Now, it's the bill. The next phase of the climate action plan is what really needs, what would be the what I call the milestone, the massive milestone, because a lot of people said last week, oh, we had this and we missed it, but we didn't, because the next stage of the climate action plan is what's really important. It's what draws out whether these ambitions can be achievable or how it can be achievable. How do we achieve them? And it's the next stage of trying to work together and making sure that all elements of your society actually buys in. And this is why we have the consultation phase as well. But to have like 51% reduction by the end of the decade is really ambitious. I'd like someone to tell me it's not. So
it's massively ambitious. Yes. And you know, I'd be the first to be critical if I thought it wasn't. It's massively ambitious, but implementation is hugely different from ambition, you know? And my underlying concern is we have, you know, we're still talking about how we're going to do this. Meanwhile, we do this in an economic model that is built on continuous growth. And I wonder if you've picked the right dance partners for that, because I don't know how much they're going to be. Some of this, they've agreed to in principle. It's the wins when you start to look to get things implemented. Where will that come? And that is a big challenge for you and your party.
Well, and I think this is the thing. Everyone goes, did we pick the right dance partners? Like you know how I voted. I wasn't shy on telling people whether I would be against going into government this way or not. I was against it, but we are where we are now. And if these dance partners that we've chosen, who have actually been very good at buying in and feeding into this bill, if they are willing and they get to the stage where the implementation is something they can get behind, then that's actually that's ambition realized and 10 times more, because you're talking about people and you're talking about people who represent certain groups who may never have come to the table. So in one way, maybe it's a massive flaw in some eyes, people's eyes, to say we're in this coalition trying to implement this. But to me, if we can implement this within this coalition with these partners, then we have done something quite spectacular. So now the question is whether we can. Back to your point of whether we can. I'm not being naive, idealistic here. I think there is a push. There does need to be a compromise and push here. And I do hope that our coalition partners will come along with us. But the bill, I think, also showed, because it puts things in a stretch tube footing, that if they were going to push back, this would have been a good part or point of them pushing back as well. So,
yeah, it's going to put some of the targets in law. Like there was awful stuff at the beginning where it was, you know, but pursuing something and actually doing something is very different. And that language had to be changed. It was very woolly. It was loophole heavy. But we've moved that on now, and some of this is going to become law and actually targeted. My other concern, though, again, to push back on that, is to say that Ireland has had a history of signing up to things that we have to do. And if we don't do them, we face fines, and we just pay the bloody fines and don't do them. So it is a concern for me.
It is. It's a concern for everyone, though, Tony. I think we've gotten to a stage where I know a lot of people will go, oh, this won't happen, and we'll just have to start afresh in 5 years or 10 years time. But we don't have 5 years. We don't have 10 years when it comes to this. And I think everyone at the table or outside the table knows this. So I would be the first to be quite kind of questioning of these things. But I think with how this has played out, I like to make sure we have a bit of faith. And if the climate action plan falls short, then yes, we will, of course, all receive the criticism and then more. Because if it falls short, it's not just criticism point. It's a question of whether we have fulfilled what we've gone into government for. So, and right now with the bill, we've fulfilled part of what we've gone into government for.
Yeah, I see. This is going to be the question. You, I'm sure you have to ask. I'm sure Patrick, your partner has to ask. Is this the price? Because as I said, you've lost colleagues, you've lost comrades in along the way, and people have fallen off. There's other, you know, we've seen other parties of the left trying to eat your dinner now, where they're rebranding as eco-socialists, or there's talks of all of this. Has the party itself, you know, like, do you think there's a scope? Because you're the chair of the party. Is there, are you looking at that now? Sorry,
I still the chair of the party.
Yeah,
ask me next week.
currently, but in that position though, are the conversations happening there that people understand that a part of that vote that you helped bring you to power is at risk, because you risk losing that now as other parties of the left rebrand or regroup into that space?
Yeah, it is a risk. I've had that conversation with many people, so I can't break confidences on where those conversations are.
Oh, wait, well, I know your party has NDAs signed now. What is with that?
Don't. We'll get on to that in a second. But in terms of... Do we know there's a risk? Yeah. Like, I think you'd be blind to not see the risk right there in front of your face of when we went into government. And this is why a lot of people ask why then you don't leave, or why do you encourage this? Because we are now at this juncture where we're part of this coalition. And for me, definitely as chair, is to make sure that we have a partnership that works, but at the same time that we get as much as we want, and not as much as we want, as much as what is needed for the public. And one of the massive things needed is the climate bill, and it is a climate action plan. And the risk is there. Like, it could well be that we go into next election and not be there anymore. A lot of people have speculated that the Greens will be gone by the next government. I hope not. So I think right now our plan is to make sure that doesn't happen. But at the same time, no one really knows. So
yeah, there must be small encouragement from the latest opinion polls, though, that it hasn't. Yeah. It has been better in terms of that, and you know whether there's listeners listening to this scratching their heads going, how? But it doesn't really matter. That they've been the Greens have slowly been creeping up in the opinion polls, almost close to how they polled in the general election last year. In fact, actually, within the margin of error of that space.
5% is good. 7% would be better. So, yeah. But it's definitely better than 2%. But then you look at the fact that there has been good, like there's been stumbles, and there's been issues, and there's been, Jesus, we all know some of the stuff that has happened, but there has been good work. Like, and I will be one of the first people to criticize, you know that. So, but I have seen some of the good work that has come through Eamon's office and Roderick's office and Catherine's office. And those are things that we can honestly say, if we weren't in government, that wouldn't happen. The climate bill wouldn't happen if we weren't in government. The thought of having a universal basic income for creatives wouldn't happen if we're not in office. So integration funding, it will happen, but would it be as big as currently? I don't think so. So there are things now, there are issues. Like, we all know there's issues. If I came on and say, oh, there's absolutely no issues, then,
I mean,
yeah, you'd turn me off.
I would. I'd turn around and say no, because I mean, I look on the one hand and I speak to, I know Nessa was working on, you know, a well-being index as opposed to how, yeah, really, really great stuff. But she also stood up and voted against the government and that's on the record now. She said no. And then we look at it today, there's going to be changes in restrictions. And if we lift this 5K ban, does that mean evictions are back on the table, Hazel? You're the Lord Mayor of Dublin. You know homelessness is still a huge issue.
Absolutely.
So how do you reconcile that?
You reconcile it by pushing the people that are in coalition with you, that you make them understand well, and they do in part. Like, I love to take, like, I know there's this whole narrative that, like, the people in Fianna Gael and Fianna Fáil don't understand, but in some, like, they do. So I've worked with a few of them. I'm not defending anyone, but there are people who would listen. Now, would they agree with you to the same extent? Absolutely not. But it's our job then to push, and they will push back in other ways as well. Like, Nessa is a perfect example that you mentioned there. Like, you know, everyone knows her views of going into government, but she is one of the hardest workers I know. And she is one of the people that created our policies in the Green. And she will always be there to make sure that her constituents and the most vulnerable are protected. So she would be one of those ones that are would push back no matter what. And Patrick would be another one. So, and I know a lot of our members of PP would. And it's like, I'm not saying it to line it up as a almost we have to push back. This is an internal war within coalition. It's not that, but it is politics. So there's a lot of trying to make sure that be it that infection bans or other elements like the whole housing issue. Like we've had, and I know you and I and other people have had conversations about what the hell are we doing with housing? So what can we do to push on housing as well? So, and these are all things within this government's lifetime would come up and be raised as questions. But then it's our job to make sure that it's not just a question mark over it, that there are solutions proposed. So, and yeah, hopefully sometimes they're workable solutions.
Yeah, I homelessness went up at one point during a pandemic. And that should never, ever, ever be the case. Yeah. Like, that's a failure of policy and that's a failure of ambition, especially since, you know, that we've seen where, you know, capacity was, there was more capacity and there's more to do. I know you're working with the task force. I know time is kind of limited. I do want to ask though.
No, it's okay.
Okay, so just in terms of though working with the partners within the Dublin City Council in homelessness, we've seen, you know, properties that were unfit recently without fire safety certificates and private run for profit organizations. Really great work, by the way, to the Dublin Inquirer, Louise and Nayland. Got to credit the people who actually did the work. Are we making any progress here, or are we? Because I've read some of the statements from Brendan Kenny, and they to me. They contradict what was said in some of the reports, the reporting that I've seen, that it was like they visited separate different buildings and got different aspects of it. I couldn't reconcile it.
This is the thing. Nisha does amazing work. So, and there are reports out, and those reports were good to see, good to have. The contents of it were appalling. So, but then in terms of Brendan and what he was saying, I think what was the explanation given is within myself and Brendan have talked a lot about housing and homelessness. A lot of people look at Brendan and go, the statements he give shows as if he doesn't care. The man cares a lot. And I'm not just defending him for the sake of it. I'm defending him because we've worked together. He's worked with a lot of people within this area, and he's worked in this area for a long time. And I think he knows that there are gaps, and he knows that there are certain things that has to be done and has to be done better. And in relation to the internal inspections of emergency accommodation, he said himself that there would be better standards and outsourced, not internal provider to make sure that there is a up to scratch standard, including within that is the fire safety. But this comes back to, and I don't mean to say it's a communication always, but there is things that I don't think the council communicates well. The council, and I've said this to the council themselves, that sometimes, be it intentionally or not, they come across not as if they're caring when there is a lot of work done in the background. So like, but there are some things that councillors will always fight, and external will always fight with council, like Oscar Traynor being a very good example. So like what the management and also the department want may not be what the councillors want. And what the councillors are proposing is that the tenure mix leans more towards social housing, leans more towards public and social housing, which is 40%. So, and this is something that may not be acceptable, but again, that's the push. Does it mean that the council and the council management, like Brendan, doesn't care? I don't think it does. I think it's just sometimes it gets lost in communication or lost in translation.
I watched that vote live online, and you were chair as the mayor, and I have to say I really enjoyed it. It was like, for me, it was like watching one of my favorite sitcoms because I mean that in such a way, is because it was obvious that the vote was going to go I'm going to say our way, as in parties of the left. It was going to go our way, and watching other faces get redder was kind of good. It was good for my soul. Nonetheless, the idea of public housing on public land, I don't think should be that radical a concept. And I do, I'm going to say, I've spoken to the Minister for Housing, and I know he's making, you know, he's making moves further from his, say, his predecessor in that direction. Has he moved far enough for me? No, of course not. But are we looking at what things are we going to do here? My concern, obviously, is around, like, Dublin City Council has a lot of land still in land banks that, well, and they're not hoarding it, but they are looking to use a model of delivery that is very expensive, Hazel. And you guys have to work that through and somehow deliver value and expediency, because the process is needed now. So, and no one has actually, and even though the proposal, by the way, I think for the Oscar Traynor Road is a bit, the current one from the councillors is a bit of a compromise.
It is a compromise. I know, I'm sure Ciarán Perry won't mind. I hope he doesn't mind. And if he does after hearing this, please let me know, Ciarán. But he had proposed a higher amount in terms of social housing, and that there'll be no, I'm trying to revise what those meetings, because I'm part of that task force as well, that there either be no affordable, and that it'd be mainly cost rental. And what the compromise was then was that there'd be affordable, there'd be cost rental, and there'd be social. And that is the compromise at the end of the day, because we've moved, and I know some people would perhaps like it entirely social. So, but then we also, like, apart from a housing list,
I do think we need to push away, and this is me pushing back, saying we need to move away from the idea of social and just talk about public. I genuinely believe that because it's, you know, when you think of the models that work internationally, it's for a range of incomes. It's not just for people who are at a lower socioeconomic income class, you know, and we have to have that ability that we can have that, whether it's a Vienna cost rental model or and have a mix of social in there within public housing, you know, and it absolutely, like, because, you know, as someone who grew up in Ballymun, the stigmatization of the area because somehow it was supposed to be, you know, we don't want to build. And this comes from Simon Coveney during his time as a housing minister, said, we don't want to build new ghettos. Sorry, I didn't grow up in a ghetto. I didn't whatsoever. And we need to move. Maybe I'm personalizing it, but it's something.
No, I don't think you are. Like, I don't think you are at all, because I think when you label something a certain way, people, it is stigmatizing it, and people never really grow out of it. And comments like that, I don't think it's right. I had people previously saying to me, I would have worked on St. James' Gate site up in Dublin 8. Mm. And some people had said to me, oh, we don't want to make sure we don't build as many social housing because there's already a lot here. And they're going, so what? Like, what is your point here? And this is why when you call it social, I agree with you. I think it needs to be public, because I think once you say social, there is that kind of connotation that it's not good, when I don't see it being a problem. It's not even seeing a problem.
Yeah, but it gives an echo of the undeserving poor sometimes.
Yeah. This is a massive, this comes back to myself and someone was talking about kind of race relations in this country. And then I brought in the fact that there's a lot of unresolved class issues that we have in this country as well. Mm. And you can see it massively so with the recent Beacon vaccines. And you can see it even when we talk about public housing, when people call it social housing and then say, oh, we don't want our ghettos to be here. That is a class divide that we've never moved away from.
Yeah. And I'm so glad you brought it up, because, you know, the struggle for class is the same in many ways. The big fear, what's happened across some countries, is where the class struggle tended to exacerbate some of the race tensions, and it's gone. I think, and that would be a major concern here, that we actually play into that, because there is a playbook. It can be done quite successfully, and you can hear the rhetoric as you talk. Look, you don't need me to tell you, you're an actual victim of ongoing campaigns of racism. Like, there's no question about it. And, you know, All we can do as straight white middle class men is try and be proper, you know, active allies and call it out and not put up with it. But we also have to ask, people who are in those minority communities, what can we do? What do we need? Not as opposed to us telling. I do want to ask, just in terms of the your term as Lord Mayor, that's not going to what do you feel that you'll have achieved by the end of it, and do you think that it was a position that deserves, then, I suppose, I'm getting at what I'm hinting at is, do we need a directly elected mayor in Dublin?
We do. And feel free to be blunt. Don't worry about hinting. I'm very good at accepting any questions or criticism if it was one. But directly elected mayors, we absolutely need it. I think, if anything, I'm hoping there's a part of me or this year that has shown that the role of the Lord Mayor can be different. I'm not saying that I've completely reformed anything, but we've had to do things differently this year. We've had to move away from the ceremonial ribbon cutting because we haven't had any of that. So it's not that I didn't want to do it, but we didn't have it. So instead we went, the office here has gone more into the feeding into the kind of policy and management role. So the discrimination agenda, being able to build the integration strategy was really important. Like, we had an integration strategy that started off for the first time in the last term, in the last 5-year term of the council. I don't know anyone that knew of it, because it was very much a strategy that sat on the shelf. What I really wanted this strategy for the next iteration is that it would benefit people like my own parents, who came over here and met over here 45 years ago and didn't speak a word of English and needed to know how to integrate within the community. And that's how we start repairing these divisions that we have when it comes to kind of minority spreading all sorts of lies, and minority spreading minority groups as in certain groups.
Sorry,
I just want to explain it in case someone comes back and say she says it was minorities. that sometimes happens, but it's spreading lies. The other thing, like being able to tie into homelessness and housing, like your point there earlier on was, I created a task force that's supposed to look at these issues. And a lot of people would go, well, what has actually happened? Is it just suggestion? Is it just going to the minister and then saying, oh, listen, this needs to be done, to him then pushing back, going, yeah, we'll look at it. It has actually, out of the top five recommendations, one of the first ones in terms of day service, Brendan has told me that's what they're starting to actually implement. So be it that it was a push from us, it was a push overall, it has helped push something in the right direction. And that's what this role should be. It should be there to try to influence, but also there to roll up their sleeves and work when needs be. And does that mean it needs a directly elected position? Yes, because I think whoever, if it was directly elected, if they become, and this is something myself and Owen Keegan had talked about, he had envisaged it that the directly elected mayor, if there was to be one, would take on a lot of the chief executive's powers, and the chief executive would then become more of an administration head role, and that could work. Now, last time it was proposed, one of the council groups objected to it, but I'm hoping next time it comes around, they've already seen it in Limerick, hopefully they see that it could work. Like, and the other thing we need to look at is a nighttime mayor as well, which is something that our colleagues have proposed. Like, I sit on the nighttime economy task force from the department, and looking at it, it does need someone to oversee the overall what nighttime society would be. Because there's a whole range of things we can do. Like, I have family in Hong Kong. So, like, looking at Hong Kong, it never sleeps. So I lived in New York. Again, there is so much that can be done for families, for singles, for elders, for younger people, all through the evening.
Yeah, I have to second that, because I do think my big fear is someone I used to go into. I was in school in Brunswick Street, which is, you know, just a stone's throw from sort of Henry Street. And I remember I remember town being more where families could live, where people could go, you could actually have that. And we have seen a hollowing out of that, whether you want to call it gentrification or, I mean, go back and listen to the podcast we did yesterday with Phil Lawton, the Trinity geographer. And he talks really well about kind of the donut city and how these things are working and how we need to do it. But we need to be more ambitious for the city. Absolutely, we do. It can't just be an economic engine. It has to be a place where people can live, and there has to be creative spaces, because we've had a deficit of them over the last while as well. Hazel Chew, Lord Mayor of Dublin, Hazel Chew, I really appreciate you taking the time to talk to us. I understand that the election is probably a fait accompli.
It's done. I've lost already. So I'm fully happy to admit that. So, but it doesn't mean that people don't belong on the ballot. I think a lot of people say, oh, that's a high price to pay for making a point. But when are people going to realize these points have to be made? Otherwise, we never move the dial whatsoever.
No, I second that. And actually, I'm hoping to talk to Mary Lou MacDonald in a few hours. I might ask her for those 41 votes.
Can you ask her for a vote, please?
I think they have 41. I still won't get you there.
It won't, but at least it'll look like people do support the issue. And there is an issue. A lot of people go, oh, it's just her ego or her being opportunistic. I didn't run in General 2020 because I wanted to be that good soldier and make sure we don't have divisions. I didn't throw my hat in for Shannon 2020 after not being selected for the same reasons. And also because my ego isn't that big. So I'm doing it now when I know it's a no-hoper, because enough is enough. So it's about time that we decide representation matters and that people are going to support it. And if there's a pact in place and people have to support each other in that pact, absolutely. But I'm hoping the ones who aren't part of the pact will understand why I'm doing this. And it's not just doing it to give my party a slap. Absolutely not. If anything, I want people to see that Greens are progressive, especially when it comes to these issues. So you can't be what you can't see.
Yeah, we'll leave it there. Listen, a quick reminder, folks, it is patreon.com/tortoiseshack. So yeah, very much in that vein. If you want progressive media, you do have to support that as well.
Yes, absolutely. Okay. I'm a supporter. I think everyone should support.
Thanks very much.
Tony and Martin, Martin and Tony, speaking to interesting people only. It's the Echo Chamber Podcast. Subscribe now on Patreon.